A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
England, like, we've all got this thing to be hard and tough, but in these countries people just don't want to know about it, like, and I just blame, like, you know, I'm not political, but I just blame the government for what they're doing.
Good evening. More than 100 people have been injured tonight in serious rioting across central London. What began as a peaceful mass demonstration against the poll tax by more than 50,000 people ended in violence. Cars have been overturned and burnt, shops looted, and more than 300 people have been arrested. The trouble is still going on.
This is Gascoigne, did well. Ball is up front, Lineker is over on the right wing. Ferenc challenges Gascoigne, free kick given to England.
It's difficult because they're all young people, they're all football fans. They have a special behavior when they are all together, because if you talk to them separately, one by one, I think they're excellent. But when they are all together, they are bound to behave in a strange way that I do not really understand yet.
And chipped in.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Opposite me is Jonathan Wilson. And today on the pod, we have Tom Holland, historian with a particular focus on ancient Rome and has a number of best-selling books on topics including classical and medieval history and the origins of Islam and Christianity as well. Tom, pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've gone for a match at the 1990 World Cup in the second round. It was England 1, Belgium 0. Why have you chosen this match, Tom?
Well, the 1990 World Cup is obviously the tournament for people who don't really know very much about football. So I'm going to put my hand up on that. But it was, I kind of have interests in sport that come in and out of focus. And for some reason, I was obsessed by football that particular summer. And I think it's to do with the fact that it was a kind of very emotional time for me because my girlfriend, who would ultimately become my wife, had been in America for a year in California. And she was coming back in the middle of this tournament. And so the kind of the week before she came is when the World Cup began. And I was staying in this squat in Camberwell. And I was so excited about her coming back. And in some way, the excitement and the build up to the World Cup became a kind of way to distract me from it. So England had been shoved off into kind of penal exile on Sardinia so that their fans wouldn't run amok. And the group matches were going on before Sadie, my soon-to-be wife, was coming back. And I went and watched every single one of them. And all the pundits said that these were incredibly tedious, dreary draws. But to me, they were very exciting. I think because the sport that I enjoy most of all is cricket. So I watching very dreary draws. It's kind of, you
know, I
didn't really see what the problem was. And then she came back, and the first thing we did, we went off on a cycling tour around France, and we ended up in a bar for the England Belgium match, and sat down to watch it, and there was the excitement of her being with me. The excitement of being English, watching it in a French bar, so not entirely knowing which side the French were going to be on, and then the kind of the long drawn out tension of the result, and then the kind of climactic goal being scored in the final minute. And I don't think I've ever, I probably have, but I mean, certainly it's among the probably the top five spectator moments where I just thought that, you know, I was going to die of excitement and happiness and joy when, Sadie was next to me. Mm-hmm. And it turned out the French, of course, I should have realised, were completely on our side against Belgium.
Oh, they were?
Yeah, they were completely on our side.
Oh, right.
And after the match, they all bought us drinks, and it was just an incredibly kind of happy moment.
Yeah. See, my moment of, we'll get obviously to the match in a bit, but my moment of that euphoric moment or memory of that moment, the goal going in, was ripping my pyjamas in celebration.
Well, I was in a bar, so I couldn't do that.
Yeah, but presumably your pyjamas were intact.
They're a traditional English way of celebrating. Take your trousers off and rip them to confetti.
Accidentally ripped them. It wasn't some sort of ritual in the Speller household.
I was watching it at home in Sunderland, which coincidentally is where your wife is from.
That's
so
right,
that links in.
Yeah.
Get the Sunderland reference in early. My dad was a very, very unemotional man, and he watched a lot of football, but basically he didn't respond to it. And if something was really, really good, he might go, huh? And I remember him going, huh? When this goal went in.
Which is elongated.
Jesus, that's a big one. Yeah.
what a moment it was.
Yeah, and you sort of, you know, you kind of, one of the great things, and I think a lot of people have this about that summer, because that summer was one of those occasions. I guess people got to an extent in 2018, but yeah, you know, I was in Russia, so it's different when you're not there. People remember the sort of the people they were with, they remember the family moments, and that's one of the great things sport has.
I can remember every pretty much kind of every moment of that tournament. Where I was, what we were doing, partly because we were going around France. And then I remember the England-Cameroon match, we were on a cross-channel ferry. And so this was before mobile phones or anything. And not knowing what the result was unbearable, absolutely unbearable. And then watching the semi-final in a German pub, surrounded by Germans. and then going outside after it finished and hearing, I think it was somewhere in the West End, and hearing the sound of Mercedes and BMWs being smashed up by marauding mobs.
Deary me. But yeah, I mean, the World Cup, you know, in Italy, I can remember watching, you know, that was the first tournament that I came in at, and a lot of the coverage on the television back here in good old Blighty, they were tapping into that great history of Italy. And Rome in particular.
Well, Nessun Dorma was the theme music.
In the background, yeah.
And I think that was a huge part of making it seem faintly sophisticated. You know, well, it's exciting.
You know whose decision that was? That was Barry Davis who suggested it.
But to Pavarotti to sing that?
No, the BBC should adopt it as its theme.
Well, it's actually, from my point of view, very annoying, because I'm in the midst of, with a couple of friends who are musical. We're doing a Mamma Mia type opera where it's entirely, we tell the story of Cleopatra through world famous arias.
And of course, they're all out of copyright, so it's brilliant. So we, you know, it's not like you have to pay money to ABBA or anything. And they're all got out of copyright, apart from the libretto for the words for Ness and Dorma, which I guess were copyright, were still within copyright in 1990. And the people who wrote them copyrighted them, bastards. So that's the only one we can't use.
I mean, it would have been a bit of a cliche, surely.
Yeah, but we want cliches.
I suppose, yeah, if you're doing something.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, sometimes they're there for a reason, Jonathan. You know, but yeah, so that kind of, you had the World Cup in Italy, this great footballing nation that, you know, not long been world champions previously. Some of the stadia that were there, you know, the San Siro, certainly from the outside, looked very futuristic and it looked quite magnificent. You know, obviously, once you got in, that might not have been the case, or certainly not in the modern era anyway. But there was that kind of historical angle of the history of this country and the football. You know, they were world champions, as we've spoken about previously on podcasts, in the 30s and so on. But I don't know, it wasn't like football's coming home, because obviously that's what England
but
would
think,
claim.
But I think there was a kind of redemptive quality about England, because I think that there was some kind of rejigging of the seeding. Mm. I think England was seeded above Spain, and the Spanish thought that this had been done, and maybe it was, to ensure that England would be in Sardinia.
Yeah.
And the reason for that was that people were worried about hooliganism. So they thought that if they isolate them on the, you know, I mean, this is what the Romans did. They would send troublemakers off to remote islands in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
And basically that's what the football authorities were doing.
Old practices die hard.
Yeah, exactly. And so of course, every time England or any England team go on into an international tournament at that time, there was enormous feelings of anxiety about, you know, were they going to just smash places up? Were England going to be thrown out?
Well, no, I think 1990...
And that didn't happen. And the other thing that happened was that there was anxiety around the England team. Robson, I think, got injured, didn't he? As ever.
But I mean, his injury was ridiculous. He got injured on a piss up. He dropped a bed on his foot.
Yes. So there was all part of that. So it felt like it was boiling up to a kind of classic English screw up.
And then
it came out. And then the person who came in to replace Robson was David Platt, who scored the redemptive goal and who was playing for Aston Villa, which was the team I supported. So in every way, it was.
But I think your point about the fans is it was particularly acute then, the fear, because of what had happened in the previous 5 years. That you'd had this series of tragedies, which, although of the three tragedies, only one was, you know, of Heysel, Bradford and Hillsborough, only one was caused by hooliganism. There was part of a whole sort of culture of this sport is sinking, and it is a terrible, terrible thing.
But also that England was sinking relative to countries that were more civilised and sat around enjoying aperitifs in squares, while our brave boys would get massively pissed and smash up shop.
I mean, it's also...
And that didn't happen.
Well, it did.
There was a bit of crowd trouble.
It didn't happen to the same extent. And I think certainly by the end of the tournament was a recognition that the overreaction or the fact the Italian police were so prepared for trouble actually helped create, on occasions, trouble. So I think when we talk about 1990 as being redemptive, It's very easy to get suckered in by the myth. It wasn't...
But I love getting suckered in by myth. That's the whole point. I was coasting the myth.
It's classical history.
You know, I wanted to believe it. And so I was very happy to just kind of go along on that wave of rising optimism.
I mean, the same...
And not being a journalist, I wasn't interested in what was actually happening.
Yeah, only being a historian, the actual facts.
I was enjoying the moment. I was, you know, it was kind of like cresting the wave. And it wasn't just about the fans, but it was about the England team.
Yes, and
the team won the fair play award at the end.
And the team, absolutely, there's a sea change, and one I think that is hugely significant for football as a whole. The England finally got rid of the back four. They were finally prepared to countenance the idea that you don't have to play with a back four.
That was seen against the Dutch, wasn't it?
Yes, so they played against the Irish with a back four. Yeah. An awful game, 1-1 draw.
Which I enjoyed hugely.
And then they go to a back three against the Dutch and play much, much better.
And should have won.
And there's a recognition that we didn't call it a back three then, we called it a back five.
Yeah.
And I guess when you have Parker and Pierce as your two fullbacks, they aren't wingbacks, it is a back five. But this sort of sudden realisation the country came to as a whole that actually back five can be more fluid and more attacking than back four. It's not as simple as the more numbers you have at the back.
But you see, Jonathan, that's where the fair weather football fan comes in, because I wasn't thinking of it in those terms.
Right, but
I was just thinking, ooh, we haven't lost yet. That's basically the level I was operating on.
In the football media, there's this sort of realization, suddenly there's a tactical discussion of a kind we'd never had before. And there's an amazing bit in Pete Davis's book, All Played Out, which is one of the classics of British football, or British sports literature, and it really sort of paves the way for a lot of the great football books that follow that decade, where he gets incredible access, and he interviews Bobby Robson on a regular basis, and Bobby Robson at times was quite prickly with him, and he's talking about the back three to the back five, back four to Robson, and Robson suddenly snaps and says, the back four's not finished. It's not, this is not the end for back four. Don't talk about back four as being archaic and the back five as being the future. Liverpool always play a back four. Are you going to tell me they're never going to win another league title? And at the time of recording, they still haven't. Which is a remarkable, Robson's insight, without really meaning to have the insight, is an incredible thing. That football did change. And of course, the back pass law 92 accelerates all of that. But it was I think the redemptive quality of that tournament was for the football itself rather than for the fans around it.
Wasn't that rule brought in because it was felt that the matches in the 1990 World Cup had been incredibly boring?
Absolutely, yeah. Which is something that people in England sort of, and I guess Ireland and maybe Cameroon as well, tend to overlook because we all enjoyed it so much.
Yes, but also Ireland were enjoying being bored. I mean, that's how they got through. They'd bore away and then win it on penalty.
And they're still struggling with that identity. And,
yeah.
But there's that great line, I can't think which Irish writer it is who wrote it, but he said, I missed the 1990 World Cup. I was in Italy at the time. I sort of felt that a bit in Russia, that I was seeing these pictures from home of people jumping on bus stops at Clapham Junction and everybody going berserk, throwing beer in the air. And there was me sitting in a flat in Kazan or in Samara, watching these games alone.
But you see, I
take it from me, it was a lovely old time.
I think having been marinated in cricket did help, because a crucial part of cricket is obviously that there are very, very long stretches where lots of nothing much happens. So you are kind of used to the idea of that actually being a source of some excitement and tension. And those qualifying matches, that's pretty much what I felt.
Yeah.
I mean, they were objectively very, very boring, and everyone said they were very boring. And I'd read I'd listen to the comments, at half time and then after the match, and I'd read the newspaper reports. But I found them excruciatingly exciting. And then when, in the last game, they got the one goal victory.
Over
which
Egypt.
I think, it was the only match in the qualifying group, I think, that...
And that particular group wasn't a draw. That's right, yeah.
So exciting, I think.
But presumably,
and then the Belgium match exactly followed the same pattern.
Well,
it was very, very kind of
But you must have loved the Belgium game, because
love it. I mean, I hated it.
Well,
the
way it played out, because in cricket, of course, there are few moments in cricket where it is the most exciting sport in the world. We saw that in the in the One Day World Cup, England, New Zealand, and so on. When it goes to the wire, because everything's hanging on it. And actually, there are moments when someone will, even if it's a draw in cricket, a draw still means that someone's won and lost, usually, if you see what I mean, especially when the Ashes are concerned. And with football, when it goes deep into extra time, we have to have a winner sooner or later, and that tension's building up. And whether it's a penalty shootout or a goal in the last minute.
But I think you knew that penalties were coming.
Yeah.
So you knew.
And we'd never had that.
Yeah, absolutely.
England had never been involved in a penalty shootout before.
Yeah.
So there was a kind of part that we're thinking, well, okay, so this is going to be a draw because everything else has been a draw. So I can just sit back and screw up the tension, ready for the penalties. So it came as a surprise. The goal came as a surprise.
Indeed. All right. Let's talk about the game then in the second half.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Welcome back to the Greatest Games podcast on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. Right then, let's get down to it. The game happened on a balmy night in Bologna, I believe. And I mean, Jonathan, what do you remember of this? I mean, England, they just sort of... I remember one commentator describing... Well, it was actually ahead of the semi-final, saying England have coughed and spluttered their way to the semi-final, but they're here. You could say that they coughed and spluttered their way through the group as well. Were you confident against Belgium? Because it was a good Belgium side.
It was a really good Belgium team, and they had also been seeded. They'd slightly messed up their group,
yeah.
And Spain had ended up going through top of that group. But you know, they got the semi-finals in 86. England's history with Belgium had been troublesome. You know, they struggled against them in the Euros 1980. I think we all knew that, you know, Schifo and Koolemans were Van der Elst. You know,
they had a good side,
probably the best holding midfielder in Europe at the time. You know, they had their Prudhomme in goal was a, you know, sort of larger than life figure. You know, we knew they were a good team with good players, and I think that, yeah, there was a general respect for Belgian football. I mean, Anderlecht, okay, it turned out they were cheating, but they did win the UEFA Cup in 1984. You know, again, you sort of, it's only 30 years ago, and yet it was a time when Belgian clubs were to be respected in a way that they're not now. Your Club Brugge had played Liverpool in the European Cup final in 1981.
Mm. Well, Brugge would then get
so,
to the...
So, hang on, 78.
Yeah, well, Brugge, of course, would get to the... It was an odd structure of the European Cup at the time, but they would get to the semi-final in a group with Rangers, Marseille.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the semi-final was two groups of four, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. Eight teams in the semi-final. Yeah. Yeah. If you see what I mean. I mean, really, Belgium haven't had it, that sort of side, not until Russia 2018, really. You know, there was a few, one or two sort of decent sides.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
Belgium,
they've been sort of, you know, threatening to be good for sort of 5 or 6 years, but it was, you know, under Roberto Martinez, slightly oddly, they finally kind of...
That, you know, potential, Jonathan.
Yeah.
That
but
potential.
You're right. And, you know, it was... I don't know. I think you'd think there were worse teams you could face in the last 16, but
sure.
Equally, they certainly weren't the easiest.
No, I remember the game playing out, and I was, you know, quite young at the time, and I thought, this is fantastic. You know, England, you know, they're in their stride now, and they're going to be okay. And I just remember... It was probably Barry Davis on commentary. I remember him bemoaning the fact that Cameroon in the next round were passing the ball a lot better and Barry Davis was giving England no leeway. So I probably, I suspect that was the same in the Belgium game. But I just remember
Barry was always very stern about England. He always felt England could be slightly better than they were.
I tended to agree with him, though, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying he wasn't right.
He's always right. Yeah. But against Belgium, Belgium just looked technically superior to England. You know, they hit the post and
hit the post twice. I mean, Koolum and Dan Schieffer both hit the post.
I just thought England were on the ropes a bit for most of that first half.
That was very much the opinion in the French bar as well. the French people who were watching it with us were worried for us.
Oh, that's kind of
They were. Obviously couldn't hear any commentary at all because there was just a hubbub of French in the background.
It's quite nice to hear this because normally, you know, I associate if you're watching with anyone who is not English, they want England to lose, you know. So these...
I think we so obviously wanted England to win.
Yeah.
We were so anxious about it. And the kind of the dread. I mean, I wasn't enjoying it at all.
Yeah.
And I think it must have been written on our faces. And so I think that, you know, they were probably neutral. You know, who do they hate more, the Belgians or the English?
Well, whereabouts in France was it?
Oh, it was in Amboise, on the Loire.
Okay, so quite a long way from Belgian border. Then.
Quite a long way. A very romantic setting with kind of castles and bridges and everything.
I've no doubt.
And we were very, very skint at the time. So we were nursing a bottle of wine very, very carefully. But the kind of the combination of the setting, the sense that gradually the bar was getting behind England because they were getting behind us, made it a kind of wonderful occasion. But the fact that by the end everyone in the bar was rooting for England, you know how it is. I mean, the more that people as a group want something to happen, the more tense it becomes when it doesn't happen. So it was. I had no real sense technically of what was happening. I couldn't hear the commentary. People kept walking in front of the screen, all kinds of ways like that. But it is obviously much more enjoyable to watch a match like that than just sitting on your own in a.
Well, maybe.
I agree with you, Tom. I fully agree with
But I mean, having said Belgium probably were the better side for most of the game, hit the post twice.
They were.
But England had a goal ruled out for the most absurd offside.
Was that Steve Ball goal?
No, John Barnes.
Oh, John Barnes, of course.
So yes. It's a really nice move that Waddle to Lineker and Lineker's cross. And Barnes comes in on it and side foots it in. It's a great volley.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're Barnes who kind of had... had never quite done it in an England shirt.
Flatter to deceive it.
And it had a lot of stuff to deal with, partly because of that.
Blimey,
and partly just the awful kind of racism that surrounded English football at the time. It's astonishing watching it back to think that could ever have been given offside.
Mm. And where's VAR when you need it?
Well, yeah. And you realise that... because the cross has come from the right, and the linesman's obviously on that side, and it's almost like he's too close to the whichever Belgian player it is who Lineker's whipped the ball around, and it's like he sort of hasn't sort of taken him into account. And Barnes is in front of the defender on the far side, but he's about 2 or 3 yards behind the.
It was a very poor decision.
And I think it's Trevor Brooking doing the co-commentary, and he immediately is sort of, oh, I'm not sure about that. And then he sees it, and it's 3 or 4 yards on. It's a terrible decision.
Yeah. In the second half, though, I thought England improved. And I can remember...
Platt came on for McMahon after 71 minutes, and I think that was... I mean, it's quite a negative midfield that they started with.
I remember Steve Bull coming on.
Yeah, Bull came on just after that four Barnes. So went to
bring on the Bull.
Indeed, but it's remarkable to think that an England substitute who played in the second tier of English football is coming on in a very crucial knockout game in the World Cup. I don't think... You might never see that again. Or you certainly wouldn't see it in the modern era, I don't think, considering he played what is now the championship.
Yeah, I mean, given England's injury problems before the Euros. But
could happen this summer, you're absolutely right.
He has that very good chance as well. It's in, I think it's in the first half of extra time, and Prudhon makes a very good save from him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was a difficult player to play against, I think. You know, he was all, not technically the most gifted, but he was all sort of elbows and shoulders. And
classic
people
English
love watching him.
And a great finisher.
And people, great cheer when he was
even
on.
Even as a Villa fan, you like Steve Bull?
I didn't. not at all. But I just remember the kind of
bring on the ball. Yeah. But the thing is, though, he's—I mean—he plays and looks like a stereotypical English forward, and his name's Steve Bull.
Yeah, and that's kind of great.
Yeah,
it's what you want. But we wanted Platt.
Yeah,
because both of us were Villa fans, and so we felt that he was clearly the person who should be brought on.
Yeah, and you were proved to be right,
of course. We were proved to be so right. Our punditry awed.
Yeah, indeed.
Awed Amboise.
Yeah. So the game went into extra time, and it just seemed like... I just remember watching it thinking, this is never going to end, one of those games. It was going on, and nobody could score.
But that was a familiar feeling, wasn't it, from watching England in that?
Certainly in the 1990 World Cup, it was a very familiar feeling by the end.
I mean, it just felt like kind of this was... It was like kind of, you know, those nightmares where you're running and not moving.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But by then, I mean, you perhaps remember better, chaps, but I think by extra time, the game had sort of balanced out. There didn't seem to be one team on top of the other.
I sort of always had that, when the other team had sort of hit the post a couple of times, you always have that, oh, even if we win now, we don't really deserve it.
Yeah,
we're going to have to laugh this off. Yeah, we're going to have to justify this.
I've never felt that. I mean, that's the opposite. I think they've hit squandered their chance. Now they deserve to lose.
Certainly explains the way you bat.
Yeah, well, yes. Yes, seize your chances. Grind the opposition into the dust. That's the elite attitude.
But yeah, as the game went on, I don't know if England were fitter or whether... But there was a sense that, yeah... But certainly, I think through extra time, there was no real sense of Belgium were going to score. Mm. And I think the expectation was for penalties, but England were just about on top.
Yeah.
And then they get that free kick.
Which was what, 40 yards out?
Well, it's in the centre circle, I think, isn't it? Or just outside the centre circle, but yeah.
Because
And Gazza was shaping up to shoot.
He was. That's absolutely right, because I think... Was Bobby Robson shout to him, don't shoot?
Yeah.
Because he could see.
Yeah, that's the story, yeah, yeah. Don't shoot, just put it in the box, don't shoot.
Mm. And he runs up, and it's quite an odd... The way he kind of...
Well, because it's central. It's a very difficult position to do anything with, because to play a straight ball, the pass has got to be so accurate that you don't do it. You're in that position, you knock it wide, and then put the cross.
Well, nowadays, on either side, as you say, they would have taken a short one or knocked it out wide. There's no way that they would have packed the box with everybody... Because Gazza had no one around him, in my recollection. You know, Belgium was sure that there wasn't going to be a short pass. They knew that there was either going to be a short or in the box.
But I guess he knew it was, you know, seconds from the end. Maybe you don't have time to play it wide and get it in.
Yeah, well, true enough. But he chipped it up.
I can't remember how close to the end it was.
It was the final minute.
Final minute, wasn't it?
Was the commentary. In the final minute
of extra time, England have done it.
Yeah, and that's right. Yeah, 119th minute. He chips the ball into the box. I mean... The ball, Platt sort of swivels and volleys.
It's such a hard thing to do.
It's such a beautiful goal and a great finish. But he hands off the defender, if you pardon the expression.
Drops over his shoulder and
his happy little round head.
Yeah. From a Belgian point of view, if you're a defender and you're not marking David Platt and you see that happened and he gets a free volley, you know, 9 yards out or whatever it is and smash it in, you're thinking, how have you let that happen? Because the ball wasn't whipped in. You've got time to see it.
Yeah, and by necessity it's dinked, so it drops.
So you should have time to get in position and then and do something with that.
Yeah. But I guess
But Sodom, it went in, Jonathan.
If you're a defender and you see a ball chipped into the box in the final minute like that and it's dropping over a player's shoulder, you're probably not that worried because it's an incredibly difficult technique to he's at a bit of an angle as well, so he's got to hit it back across Prudhomme.
Terry Butcher wouldn't have let that happen at the other end.
Well, the weird thing listening to you, I haven't actually watched it since, you know, I've never watched the highlights again. I've never watched the replay.
Was that laziness or just because you don't want to spoil the memory?
I think because I don't want to spoil the memory.
Okay.
I in my memory, he's a kind of shimmer. And then I remember the ball going in, and then I remember obviously the kind of ecstasy of it.
You're going to say, in my memory, I thought it was a header.
you can't mark a shimmer.
I remember thinking, God, his head is very, very distinctive. I mean, I do remember that. So that was a part of it.
Well, he had this beautiful buff forehead.
Kind of
buff, which,
yeah, it's kind of gleam, and it would kind of, yeah.
Which he used
it,
very effectively.
Against Cameroon, yeah.
And I think I just don't want to revisit it because The memory of it was so joyous and ecstatic and perfect.
But the celebrations, though, when that goal goes in the games, that's it done.
But what I also realise is listening to you talk about the commentary and everything, is that I realise that a lot of other great sporting moments that I remember, that actually the commentary is, of course, a crucial part of it, that's part of the tapestry of your memory. But with this, because there was no tapestry, you know, there was no commentary, because it was kind of chaotic, because there were... It has a very, very different timbre in my memories.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that. Sometimes, yeah. I mean, did the French people in the bar leap up with you?
Yeah, they did, and they bought us all drinks. It was a great, great occasion. And then we kind of floated out happily and went back to our tent. And it was a wonderful evening. And then it kind of, you know, the high of that then made the rest of the tournament, you know, more and more enjoyable.
Yeah, it was a phenomenal moment. And
it was odd coming back to England and finding the whole country just completely in the grip of it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Because when we'd left, it had been kind of rather downbeat, England are dreary, nothing's happening.
Yeah,
And we came back and it was kind of the whole country was on fire.
Yeah, that goal changed things.
That sort of collective hysteria, madness, euphoria, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's easy for us to think that's a modern phenomenon, it's something of a sort of televisual age, that you need television to tie everybody together to whip that up. But I mean, did that happen before? I mean, you've obviously written huge amounts about Rome. Did Rome have equivalents to this? How important was sport to sort of general culture in Rome?
Well, there are varieties of sport, and absolutely there were for chariot racing teams of different colours.
So there were the four colours, that right?
Yeah. People were perfectly capable of, you know, we think England had problems with hooliganism in the 80s. The level of hooliganism in Rome and then subsequently Constantinople, where they actually ripped the city apart. And at one point it seemed like the government was going to fall. the rioting was so bad. The passions were incredibly intense. And obviously your dream was, Villa have Prince William to support them and Tom Hanks, and you'd think surely they can get behind the guys. But the Greens, the chariot team in Rome, had Caligula,
right?
And that was a completely different order.
It's red, white, blue, green. Is that?
Yeah.
And what determined who you supported?
Supported the Greens.
Yeah, but what determined that? Was it? I mean,
I have no idea why he supported the Greens. We just know that he did. And on the night before his favourite horse, Incitatus, who it said that he wanted to make a consul. He would go around ensuring that no noise was making so that Incitatus would have a good night's preparation. So it's a bit like, you know, the England team or teams needing hotels that are secluded away.
Absolutely. The locals, yeah.
So he would go around and anyone who caused a disturbance, you know, not a good idea.
Yeah.
And he ended up so Incitatus was kind of like the equivalent of the key striker.
Mm.
He ended up buying him an entire palace.
Blimey.
So kind of very familiar passions. And the other thing is that it gladiatorial contests as well were felt to be improving.
To witness them? Or to
witness them, because, and particularly once Rome has become a great power and individual citizens are no longer fighting, there's this feeling that watching spectacles of courage and endurance and bloodshed, so be it in the circus or be it in the amphitheatre, it improves the moral character of the Roman people. And so that's why, again, there's a very kind of familiar narrative around what stadiums should be like. Again, that's kind of familiar from the 80s and 90s. The Roman moralists think that you should stand in an amphitheatre.
Why is that?
Because this is what a Roman should do. If you can sit down on a seat, then you're going to loll around. You're going to get soft. Watching the sport is going to become a mere spectator activity. And it's very possible that you will end up breathing what comes to be called sedition. And seditio, it comes from the Latin word seditio, which means sitting down. So the debates that it's very familiar. You know, but they regarded all standing stadiums as absolutely essential. And so when the Republic becomes an autocracy and you start getting emperors who built, obviously, the largest stadium is the Colosseum. Colosseum is an all-seater stadium. And this is regarded by Roman moralists as being a kind of indicative of the growing flabbiness and softness of the Roman people, that they're not out there, you know, the equivalent would be they're not out there actually playing football in parks. They are just sitting around watching. So wow. It's a kind of equivalent of a couch potato fan.
It's a sign of things to come. but one thing, actually, I would just like to say, 1990, I think, was the last World Cup where it seemed like that the stadiums weren't always full.
Yes.
And it seemed that, I can remember England fans kind of congering down sort of aisles of seats sometimes when they were doing okay and so on. And that just didn't happen. Like, well, 94 World Cup in the States seemed that there was largely full stadiums, especially in the
I think it was entirely sold out. Yeah. I mean, it's certain. I think it's still the highest average attendance.
I think it is.
94 World Cup. Because, you know, the US fan is great at turning up and going to watch, or whatever else you think about the Americanization of sport.
Sure.
They do turn up and watch.
But in knockout rounds any World Cup since, you don't have empty, but especially England, I think even the semi-final against West Germany.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess you want a full stadium, and obviously economically for FIFA, it is better to have the tickets sold. But the great thing, if you do have tickets available, is if a team gets on a run, you can hop on a cheap flight to Italy, and you can.
And there was something about.
So
but
many.
It's weird, but it's weird. People didn't, especially for the that semi final.
Oh, I think a lot of people did.
No, they did. You would hear people, especially in Ireland.
But if there were empty seats, I mean, I don't remember that.
No, but you would hear. I know the Irish people have these stories of, you know, oh, where's your dad? Oh, he's gone out to Italy. Ireland are going to win the World Cup.
And you know, he cancelled his flight home, and he'd stay out there for two or 3 weeks. And then there's a guy I used to play football with. He actually played for Newport briefly, and he then became a journalist. But he went to Italy to watch the World Cup and didn't come home for 10 years. Stayed there. And I think there was... I'm not saying there was hundreds
of people. He never sat down in a stadium once?
Yeah, there was... You know, that was not a totally uncommon experience.
Yeah. Is the change
the fact that it is now cheaper to get around? I mean, is that the reason?
I think football's changed as well.
The idea of going... I think one of the things about 1990, it just seemed so far away and so exotic. That,
and also it was dangerous.
I remember listening...
Yeah,
it was dangerous.
Yeah,
you know,
there was that element to it.
The Rugby World Cup in Japan when England got to the final, and people were kind of spending £40,000 to fly to Japan.
Yeah.
But you couldn't, you know, which is, and rugby's much less supported than...
Well, it is supported by maybe richer people, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe that's
and
it.
And I guess they figure they can get a ticket because they can afford the black market price.
But I was kind of amazed how many people could afford to go to Japan.
There's definitely that thing where, because of the World Cup in Germany, for example, in 2006, in a way that didn't happen, to my knowledge, in 98, although perhaps it did, but people would just, I just want to be there. I just want to soak up the atmosphere. Yeah. I want to be there. There'll be fan parks as well. You knew that you would watch it. You knew there would be other supporters of your team, and there would be facilities, which perhaps previously...
Actually, the fan park thing is a big thing. But the other thing that's changed, and this was really obvious in Russia, is the burgeoning middle class in South America. That there was, it didn't matter where you went in Russia. There were thousands of Peruvians there. You go anywhere.
I haven't travelled a bit in Peru.
You think with their pipes.
yeah, that's how you recognise them. That's how you knew them.
I mean, they did get everywhere.
You could hear them before they arrived. Yeah.
But you go into literally any cafe or bar in a World Cup city, whether Peru were playing there, or had any possibility of playing there, there'd be half a dozen Peruvians.
Yeah,
because you know it was their first World Cup since 82, and suddenly there's 30,000-40,000. Peruvians could afford to go, and I guess some of them took out loans to go, figuring they wouldn't be there again in a hurry.
But I'm also wondering the semi final, the England Germany West Germany match, was that unusually high in terms of viewing figures?
In terms of TV, yeah, I think it's still.
I think it was kind of the largest ever.
I think it might still be the largest ever.
It was definitely up there.
And I wonder whether that was something that did actually change the framework of it. That TV companies realised that if we can get this, you know, get this kind of tide of passion and enthusiasm, then we can monetize it.
And because, I guess Euro 96 changed things as well. The fact it was on home soil and
Euro 96 had a huge impact here, for obvious reasons.
I mean, even that, you know, we're talking about the whitewashing power of myth. England lost to Germany there, and people went out and smashed up German cars, and as that Russian student was stabbed because people thought he was German.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very easy to see that as being
England wore horrible grey shirts in that, didn't they?
They did.
And I think it's the fact that they had these shimmering white shirts, which is also... just in terms of the
aesthetic of
the aesthetic of it.
Didn't work against Croatia in Russia, though.
The aesthetic.
No, but the weirdly, you know, think of the iconic photos of Gaza. The whiteness of the shirt, and then the kind of the dirt smears and the blood.
Well, butcher's blood, yeah.
Butcher's blood and things. There's a kind of,
I know what you mean.
It kind of enables it. It sharpens in the memory.
But there's also something about the aesthetic of that tournament to do with, it's something to do with the film that's used.
And yeah.
It looks old in a way no subsequent World Cup has looked old.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't quite understand what that is, but there's an
kind
old
of graininess to it.
Exactly.
Absolutely. There we are. Happens to us all, I suppose. Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the pod. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and experiences in that French bar.
Pleasure. Nice to revisit it.
For more stories like that, go to theblizzard.co.uk. But yeah, thank you very much, Tom. Jonathan, pleasure as always. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next week for another game from the world of football. Cheers.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.